All right, welcome back, my fiendish friends, or maybe it's more like friendish fiends. I'm Allison Dixon, and it's time to gather around for another short round of Ding Dong Ditch, the mini version of Ding Dong Darkness Time. And today, we're visiting a topic that combines history, a battle fought against all odds, chemical warfare, and zombies. You heard me right, zombies. Okay, maybe I'm employing a little clickbait magic to keep you on the hook. There aren't going to be any brain-eating undead creatures from a George Romero flick here, but the story I have for you today is about as close as it gets. And a fair warning to those of you who are a little sensitive to gruesome content, this one is going to be particularly grisly. So brace yourself and maybe grab your nearest gas mask, and barring that, maybe a rag soaked in urine. Yeah, I said what I said. Whether we're talking about the Crusades or Operation Iraqi Freedom or any of the countless conflicts in between, one singular truth is unavoidable. War is hell. And with each subsequent war throughout history, humanity's lust for developing more efficient means to kill people continues to evolve. Sticks and stones gave way to swords and arrows, gave way to gunpowder and bullets, gave way to nuclear bombs, Tomahawk missiles, and laser-guided drones capable of being launched by someone on one side of the world and then zeroing in on a single person thousands of miles away. Terrifying to even think of, really. But World War I personified the meaning of hell in a particularly brutal way, thanks in great part to the Industrial Revolution, which began more than a century prior in Great Britain. Now, you can all very easily imagine the soot-covered Dickensian landscape, I'm sure, complete with smokestacks spewing carbon clouds into a slate-gray sky, the River Thames stinking and frothing with all manner of poisons and waste. Well, that was human ingenuity at work, people, and the rapid advances in manufacturing and technology that turned a lot of cities into cesspools were also hugely consequential for militaries all over the world. By the early 20th century, armies for the first time had such marvels as motorized vehicles, airplanes, heavy artillery, chemical weapons, radios, and telephones at their disposal. And while whole episodes of this show can be dedicated to talking about each of these things at great length, I really want to focus on the chemical weapons because not only are they particularly terrifying, they play the biggest role in the story I'll be telling today. But first, let's do a little background on the use of gas in battle. Primarily, these agents are called lacrimators, which comes from the Latin lacrima, meaning tear. Yes, I'm talking about tear gas. Anyone who's watched cops break up protests or riots is familiar with these. They make the eyes water, the nasal and throat passages burn like fire. You might even carry a lacrimator on your person in the form of a pink pepper spray canister on a keychain. These early formulations, though, were primarily xylobromide or ethyl bromoacetate. It took a little bit of work to get out there. And they were usually dispersed by artillery shells. The first country to deploy such weapons actually was France in August of 1914, about a month after the war officially began. So they weren't wasting any time testing out their scary new eye and lung burning toys on people. But using tear gas in war has a few drawbacks, particularly if your aim is to kill a bunch of soldiers. Namely, the effects aren't very lethal, despite how uncomfortable they may be, and the burning tended to wear off after about 30 minutes or so. If anything, it just pissed the enemy off even more. So the occasion called for something a bit more horrific. Enter the Germans. Surprising absolutely no one, am I right? So Fritz Haber was the man who headed the development of chemical weapons for Germany, and he went right for the nightmare fuel, chlorine gas, which he debuted in a battle at Ypres, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, in 1915. Now, the description of the stuff even sounds like something dredged up from the darkest depths of a nightmare pit. Imagine being a soldier stationed in a muddy trench on a war-torn battlefield when a cloud of thick, heavy, green gas smelling of a combination of pineapple and peppers comes rolling in, rending your flesh, eyes, and lungs into bloody chunks and ribbons. See, because chlorine is water-soluble and the human body is mostly made of water, when the two combine, it becomes hydrochloric acid. And living things don't much care for this stuff. Witness accounts of chlorine gas use describe the stuff turning any plant matter yellow and black as it rolls over the landscape. Of course, the problem with unleashing a highly destructive gas agent on your enemies is that the gas in question isn't loyal to you, the watery meat sack doing the deploying. One slight change of the wind, and that cloud is coming back to offer a lethal howdy. Furthermore, the appearance and smell of chlorine gas made it easy to spot, and its water solubility actually worked against this because soldiers quickly figured out that even if they didn't have a gas mask, they could wet strips of cloth with water or even urine to reduce the chlorine's damage. So Fritz Haber decided to return to the drawing board and in late 1915 unleashed phosgene gas on the battlefields at Ypres. And friends, this stuff was a nasty character. Phosgene was more lethal than chlorine, and it was quite sneaky. While it behaved like tear gas on the outset, if it got into the lungs, it interfered with the blood-air barrier and caused pulmonary edema, which is fluid in the lungs. And a couple days later, people usually ended up suffocating to death. According to the University of Kansas Medical School article, from which I got a lot of this information, some 91,000 people in World War I died of gas exposure, and 85% of those deaths were from phosgene. But it wasn't enough to deploy one of these gases by themselves. That's because militaries were giving their soldiers gas masks. So various countries developed agents that could bypass the protection those masks offered, which caused the soldiers to remove the masks and then be exposed to the phosgene or chlorine waiting for them. There was also mustard gas, an agent that, while not considered highly lethal, resulted in horrible burns to the eyes and skin, and it has been believed to cause certain types of cancer. As I said, filthy, nightmarish stuff. Even though chemical warfare accounted for less than 1% of the deaths in World War I, its damage was more to the psyche. Subsequently, an absolute ban on gas weapons was instituted by the Geneva Convention in 1925, and they remain part of the just because we can doesn't mean we should collection alongside nuclear bombs and torture. Although they have cropped up from time to time in terrorist conflicts, such as those by ISIL and Bashar al-Assad during the civil war in Syria in the 20-teens. So take everything you know about chlorine gas and walk with me to the Auschwitz fortress in what is now northeast Poland. This fortress was a real beast, and the Germans had to take it down because it was blocking a vital route for German advancement across the Russian front. They'd thrown everything they had at this thing for months, actually, but this fortress was a Timex watch. It took multiple lickings and kept right on ticking. But now the Germans have a new toy at their disposal, a big case of chlorine gas. So it's August 6th, 1915, and imagine you're part of a Russian garrison assigned to defend this fortress against German forces. The Russians liked these heavy fortresses, actually, because it allowed for the use of fewer troops in order to defend the roads and railways, and for the most part, it worked pretty well. But German Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg wasn't about to have one more day of this nonsense. Without going too far off track, I'll just say this. Hindenburg was basically the German equivalent of a Winston Churchill or a Douglas MacArthur. In other words, the personification of manly man, military and political machine, who was a hero of his people at the time, but whose legacy is now viewed with a little more question in modern times. So go read up on him when you get a chance, by the way. His Wikipedia is about a mile long and all of it is really fascinating, especially as it pertains to the rise of Hitler. Now, there were about 900 Russian troops stationed at Auschwitz, but Hindenburg was bringing, and I quote, 14 battalions of infantry, 1 battalion of sappers, those are trench diggers, 24 to 30 heavy siege guns, and 30 batteries of artillery equipped with poison gases. All told, this force amounted to about 7,000 troops against, the 900 to 1,000 or so Russians holed up in this fortress. If you're not already getting Lord of the Rings Battle of Helm's Deep vibes, you have permission to start now. Part of the attack strategy was to sail a balloon filled with chlorine gas over the fortress, and that's what they did at 4 a.m. that morning of August 6th. And because you now know what chlorine gas does to the eyes, skin, and lungs, you know the results had to be devastating. Most of the infantry in the fortress died from the poisoning. The artillery also couldn't fire effectively as they were fighting the effects of the gas as well. Pretty much everyone in that fortress was poisoned by this gas. No one got away clean. So the Germans began their official advance, shelling the place, setting traps, all but guaranteeing themselves a victory. But as we shall soon learn, sometimes perception can be your greatest weapon, and it doesn't matter how outmatched you are. The Russian commander at Ostwitz was Vladimir Kozlinski, and he wasn't about to take this shit lying down. And I should note here that Kozlinski might have been the most senior official left at the fortress, but he wasn't really a soldier. He was a topographer, and he was fresh out of military academy. You can find pictures of this guy, by the way, on the Wikipedia entry for this and any other website that talks about the attack of the dead men. And you'll see, he's just a kid. It's just sad, really. So anyway, they had about 70 men left after the gas attack, and they'd managed to stave off death themselves by covering up with strips of wet cloth, again, either wet with urine or with water. And they decided to charge the German forces head on. Now, imagine you're the German force, convinced you're sailing into an easy victory after laying waste to hundreds of people with your deadly gas weapon. In fact, you already believe all these men are actually dead, because by all rights, they should be. Not only have you and your buddies been bombing this place to kingdom come for months, but you poured enough gas on them to choke out three times their number. Except out of the greenish mists come stumbling at you a group of people who for all the world resemble bloody, gory, shambling zombies rather than men, with their melting faces covered in blood-soaked rags, chunks of their own lungs and other viscera sputtering from their mouths as they coughed up organs dissolved by hydrochloric acid. I am not making this up, and I am not exaggerating for effect. This is the actual record. This is what this gas does to people's bodies. And man, are these guys mad as hell. So you're at the end of your life. You know you're a dead man. You have nothing left to lose. You were just going to give it everything you have. And the Germans, they were not prepared for this at all. So you, the naive German soldier, are convinced the dead have risen up to seek vengeance, because never before have you witnessed anything like this. So the Germans panicked and they fell back. Only in the process of their hasty retreat, they ended up getting caught up in their own minds and along the way, either tangling themselves in barbed wire or blowing themselves to pieces. And the opening also gave the five remaining Russian gunners an opportunity to open fire and lay a pretty good amount of waste to the force at will. Now, the German assault, which was supposed to be a sure thing thanks to the gas attack and the abundance of men that they had at their disposal, was an abject failure. Vladimir Kozlinski was mortally wounded in this battle, by the way, and he ended up dying later that night. However, his surprise attack helped the Russians hold on to the fort for a couple more weeks, at which point they decided to demolish it and retreat so that no one else would be able to take or surround it. And while the Germans did continue their advancement across that front, the Russians didn't surrender their mighty fort by any terms other than their own. Which brings me back to the discussion of chemical warfare and whether it had any real value. It sure did kill a lot of people, but it didn't exactly help anyone win. At most, its utility was as a psyop. Stories of its damage are a useful enough tool, but due to its difficulty to control and predict it, it didn't seem like a particularly effective strategy. However, I want to bring the discussion back to our German chemist friend, Fritz Haber, the one who gave the world chlorine and phosgene gas. Well, his story, much like the attack of the dead men, doesn't exactly end as one might expect. Haber also developed a process for fixing atmospheric nitrogen for the production of ammonia, which was heavily in demand in the 20th century, not only for the manufacture of munitions and explosives, but also for ammonia-based fertilizers. Prior to this process, it was impossible to develop crops large enough to sustain a rapidly growing human population due to the lack of fertilizer. So this process is largely credited for the population explosion of the 20th century and is still widely in use today. It's actually considered one of humanity's most significant technological advances. It also earned Haber the Nobel Peace Prize. And many of you listening to this right now would likely not be here without the Haber process, because your ancestors would have likely starved to death. Now, in another ironic twist of chemistry, Haber died in 1934, which was many years before the Holocaust of World War II. But many of the chemicals he helped perfect during his time were later used to exterminate millions of Jewish people in concentration camps. Though he converted to practice Christianity later in his life, Haber himself was a German Jew, and it's very likely if he'd lived long enough, he might have been one of the ones exterminated by his own inventions. It's hard to think of a life more riddled with contradictions, ironies, and consequences than Fritz Haber's, isn't it? If you do, please let me know. I'm actually kind of thinking of Robert Oppenheimer right now, one of the minds behind the nuclear bomb, but I'll save that one for a future episode. There are so many lessons to derive from all of this. When I was doing my research on the technology of World War I, all I could think was how much of a high it must have been for all these people to realize what they were capable of. They must have felt like gods. After all, it was Oppenheimer who said, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." People contain multitudes, many of them terrifying, but also completely unexpected. The very same famed chemist who used his talents to give life in the form of fertilizer also used that same brain to help snuff out countless thousands. The brave Russians at Auschwitz, who were expected to simply fall over and die under a choking green cloud, rose up and used their bodies, dissolving from the inside out, to say to a force hundreds of times bigger than them, "Not today, Satan." But those very same soldiers probably also killed a lot of people and might have committed other atrocities both before or after that siege on their fortress. People are complex beasts. If you could pan a camera around inside the mind of a single human brain, it would be like looking at a dodecahedron with some facets glimmering with the magic of hope, love, generosity, and innovation, and others as opaque and foreboding as an abyss, but all of them part of the same person. Get a bunch of those dodecahedrons together and you wind up with something like phosgene gas, a substance that has been used as a terrifying weapon of war, but is also responsible for many good things like insulation in your house or the squishy cushions on your couch. I do hope you enjoyed this brief dive into a topic that, quite frankly, could use an entire season of this show to explore. Who knows? Maybe it will be. If that's something you'd like, do reach out to me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or visit me on Twitter at ddarknesstime. You can also hop on over to iTunes and drop me a review. I'd love nothing more than to see the love for this show spread across the landscape like a gas that brings love and knowledge rather than death. That's a power you have as a member of the growing Ding Dong Army, so make it happen, won't you? There are a lot of exciting things in store for this show, but I'll be back soon with another interesting tale to help tide you over. Until then, as I always say, be good, you little ding-dongs.